Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 17th, 2016, and welcome to episode 118 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting by the old fogies who like old computers not because we think they're better, but because we know they're better. I'm your host, Ken Gagne, and joining me today is my nemesis across the river, whose artillery surely would have smote me by now if he could only get the right angle and wind resistance, Professor Paul Hagstrom. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Ken. How are you doing?
Fine. How's life on your side of the Charles?
It's cold. No snow, but cold.
Don't worry.
Is there snow over there?
It hasn't reached our side yet, but I'm sure if this winter is anything like the last one, it'll be coming any time.
Yep.
Also joining us is the inspiration for every character on Portlandia, Earl Evans. Hi, Earl.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Long time no speak.
It has been a while, Ken.
Well, you know, the holidays keep us all busy. I'm glad that you could rejoin us. I mean, you were on the show last month, but I was not. We've been ships passing in the night.
Indeed.
Indeed.
Happy that we're on together again.
Yeah, just like old times.
Collision course set.
No! We're also honored to have with us the staple of every IKEA store, that meatball, Jack Nutting.
Hey, Ken, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Jack?
Good. It's very cold and snowy in Swedenland. So it's too cold to go to IKEA.
Is it ever not cold and snowy?
Yeah, actually, sometimes it's only cold and not snowy, or just snowy and not that cold.
How can it be snowy and not cold?
Well, it can be snowy and like just barely cold, like just below freezing.
So
you just get that, you gotta get that snow and slush and just like horribleness, but without getting proper cold to keep it solid.
Oh, see, here in New England, we call that rain. Maybe that's unique to this region. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I'm dying to ask something. Is there such a thing as IKEA in Sweden?
There is. It's called IKEA.
It's not just called store.
With an umlaut.
Of course.
Umlauts.
Also on the show today is that Australian whose issue of Juice GS I always make sure to mail last, Michael Mulhern.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Michael. How are you today?
Excellent. No sign of snow here yet, but I live in hope. But we've had some 40-plus days, and then suddenly it goes down to below 20. So can't make up its mind whether it's going to burn us or freeze us yet.
But 40 degrees, that's like 110. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I decided I wasn't going to go out and do any tree clearing on that day. I just stayed inside and made sure the air conditioning was working.
Tree clearing? Are you a lumberjack?
But I'm okay.
And finally, a Canadian so impervious to pain that when he gets struck by a steel beam, the beam walks away with a concussion. Carrington Vanston.
That's actually true. I vaguely remember that moment. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Carrington, for
Hello.
The first time since last February.
I keep trying to quit this show, but nobody notices.
Aw, well, we are glad to have you back. You were last on the show in September. We last crossed paths in February. You're the reason I joined this show in the first place, and then you just up and left me. Tease.
That's me.
Yay. So, having never been the host before, I guess the first thing we do is the host topic. Is that correct?
Sounds good to me.
Excellent. Well, you know, that's the way we're playing it today. And the question for me, or for you, rather, it's my question, you're the one to answer it, is that the commercial market for retro computing is very different from what it was when these computers weren't retro, when they were the cutting edge. Nowadays, if you want a piece of hardware, for example, an expansion card or the like,
you have to wait for a run, for a production run to occur. You have to pre-order and get in line well in advance. Your order may come within a week or a month or a year of you ordering it. And hopefully the person who's shipping it knows what they're doing. It's properly packaged and you receive it. And that is very different from how any other business conducts their business today. If I were to go to, you know, even Amazon or B&H Photo and Video or anywhere else, you know, it's a pretty consistent customer experience where you find the product you want, you order it, and within a week you get it. You don't have to deal with the individual who's making it. There are people who are trained in marketing, sales, customer service, and the like. Now, obviously, there are very good reasons for these different differences and distinctions, mostly that retro computing is a hobby, not a business for many of us. Nonetheless, the people who are selling products are engaged in a professional service. They are taking your money, and they're giving you something in return. And so I'm wondering, what standards should we expect from a retro computing retailer, and should they be held to different standards from a quote-unquote mainstream retailer? Who would like to answer? Let's start with Jack.
Oh, gosh. this is a very good question that I don't have a very good answer to. But the thing that strikes me when you start talking about this is I think that the people who are kind of making hardware, new hardware, at sort of a hobbyist level, it's almost like the people on Etsy who, you know, you can say someone will knit you a pair of gloves with your name on it or whatever, right? And like, and that's a thing where you might expect on Etsy that if you're going to buy something custom built or custom knitted or whatever, you know, it might take a week or it might take a month or whatever because they might be busy. And I think the hobbyist level electronics makers today are in kind of the same place. So I think, you know, it's the fact that nowadays you can make things as a hobbyist that you could not have made 30 years ago kind of makes it that there's less of a hurdle for people to get there and say, hey, I've got a design, I could build this thing. And they don't really, if it's their first time, they don't really know what's involved and know the complexities and can think it's going to be easier than it is. So I think, you know, you kind of have to take estimates with a grain of salt. It's kind of like anything you see on Kickstarter, you know, it's like, well, sure, I'll back this thing, but even if they get their money, you know, there's a certain percentage of them that just fail to produce or fail to produce in a timely manner.
So in a way, while the barrier for entry has been lowered, so have the standards.
Right. Yep. Just by the same token that it's a lot easier now to put music out in front of people on Spotify or whatever than it was when you had to go through a record company and had to use a recording studio and stuff like that. So there's a potential for it makes it easier for people to do things, but there's also there's a risk that people who will be doing things that are not that good or will not produce at the quality or speed that is desired will still have their message out there and people can get people excited about it and then have it fall in its face.
And so in a way, we need to lower that barrier because the number of retro computing enthusiasts that we have today is much smaller than the number of mainstream Apple II users we had 30 years ago. If the barrier was as high as it was 30 years ago, we probably wouldn't have any new hardware or software.
Yes, I think that's probably true.
Cool.
So the fact that it is easier is a blessing and a curse.
All right. Well, assuming we've left anything for anybody else to talk about, let's go to Earl. What do you think?
I think that you have to take it with a grain of salt because these are amateurs that are getting into it and doing these things. It's with the best of intentions, but by the same token, sometimes people don't really realize when they're getting in over their head. Manufacture of the items that they're selling can be a lot more time consuming than what they realize. If I were going to try and make a product for sale in the retro computing community, I would definitely take the experience of some of the other folks who have done it and realize that whatever amount of work I think it's going to be, I'm going to multiply that times three and just make sure that I'm not signing up for something that I won't be able to deliver on. Also, the demand for these things can be kind of bursty too. So when you first come out with something, maybe 100 people want it. And then for 3 years, you don't get a single order because you saturated the market. And somebody else who's late to the game comes along and they go, hey, I want one of those. And then they're disappointed or dissatisfied to learn that it's going to take you a while, if you can do it at all, to gear back up to make some more of the products. That's not as much the case in the mainstream manufacturing or sales world, where you've got a bunch of professionals that sit around a table and figure out what the demand for your product is going to be, or, you know, at least they make their best projections, and you might be talking in the thousands or millions of units. And in this case, we're just talking about single digit or double digit sometimes. So that's what I think. I think you got to cut them some slack. And if there's something that you want and you look at it and you go, I think I ought to buy one of those, then maybe you ought to buy it sooner rather than later. Because if you get in late, I found this on a couple of the Commodore things, there's a chance that it just might never get made again.
Yep, that's absolutely true. Also, main takeaway from that statement is that demand for retro computing products can be bursty. New word. Thanks, Earl. Carrington, speaking of new words, you Canadians, let's hear from you.
I hold everybody to very low standards.
including yourself.
Including myself. No, the reality is I hold retro computing vendors to a different standard than mainstream vendors, and that standard is lower. Frankly, I hold them to an Etsy / Kickstarter standard, just like Jack was saying. A lot of times, like, the reality is I don't expect the same level of packaging. I don't expect the same level of documentation. If I got a product shipped in the manner and method from a mainstream vendor that I would get from a retro computing vendor, I would probably be disappointed, to be honest. So I do. I'm necessarily holding them to a lower standard. But I'm still so delighted to get things for retro computers and sort of surprised, even to this day, that new hardware, say, will come out, that I'm still very happy with it. And I'm okay with the standard. But it would be hypocritical for me to say that I'm not holding different standards there. I don't, for the most part, use Kickstarter anymore because I like to get a thing when I order it. So I don't, when it comes to materials, I don't like to, you know, invest in a Kickstarter and then maybe 2 years later something arrives. I'm like, I want it right then. So a lot of times with retro computing vendors, they're saying, hey, let's get a bunch of orders and then hopefully I'll produce a thing. I generally opt out of that sort of thing. But when something is produced, if a vendor says it's in stock, that's when I'll grab it. And like Earl was saying, I do generally use the Moscow rule of shopping. Like, you see bread, you buy bread. Don't come back later and hoping it'll be there. So if I think I might later want a product, I will immediately buy it and just stick it on the shelf just for a rainy day or what have you, because I don't expect these things to stay in stock indefinitely or even for a short time. But the reality is, for packaging, for timing, for quality of documentation, for a lot of things, I do hold retro computing vendors to a lower standard, and that's just the way it is.
With most retailers, if you wait and not buy a product when it's brand new, you can hopefully get a better deal later when it's on sale and in the bargain bin. That doesn't really hold with the retro computing community because things don't go on sale. Generally, retailers charge what they cost, and when they run out, they aren't trying to get rid of leftover stock because there isn't any.
This is true. In fact, it's almost the opposite when it comes to retro computing. Somebody will create a limited run of boards. When they're gone, they're gone. And a few people have bought a couple of them, and they will now only be available on eBay for 3 or 4 times the price.
Ugh, those people. Right. Honestly. Paul, you want to jump in here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess my thought on this is that, I mean, I guess I don't, in most cases, think of the people who are selling the boards and that sort of thing as even, you know, vendors exactly. I mean, I think, you know, they're not in the retail business. They're, I think of them, I guess, almost a little bit more like a friend who made me a thing who's mailing it to me. So in that sense, I think that the companies that I would hold accountable in some kind of way don't exist anymore. You know, it's not like, you know, I can angrily call customer service and say, you know, this thing got bent, send me a new one. It's if something goes wrong in shipping, you can call. Often people will be helpful. It's still real money you're paying, but I still don't view it like interacting with a business. I really kind of view it as kind of like more of a community thing. So, and definitely that I do the same thing with trying to get things as soon as I, you know, see them available, because I have had that happen before where, you know, the thing just vanishes after a while. There have been a few things that I have ordered and have taken a long time to arrive, you know, longer than expected. But, you know, it does sort of seem like that's just the way things are. I wouldn't have expected that if I ordered, I don't know, a book from Amazon or something. But for this I guess I can sort of put myself in their place, and I sort of feel like, you know, I also get bogged down in life sometimes, and I can understand it because they're just usually a one or two person operation.
So when something gets bent, you don't tell them to get bent.
not in those words, no.
And finally, Michael.
Well, I'm with Paul. I basically consider them hobbyists just like myself. As it's been said before, the bar's been lowered for getting this stuff. Getting PCBs created. Before, it used to be you had to etch it yourself. Now you can get that sent away. You can get small lots done, larger lots done. Things are a lot easier to get started. And I think that might be part of the problem where some people sort of get a bit carried away. They think, oh, okay, I can get these PCBs here. I can order the parts in, or I can even actually get the boards populated and soldered and actually shipped back in. Then you've got 3D printing, snazzy little custom cases for various bits and pieces. It's not that long ago where if you wanted to put your new creation into a case, you pop down to your local electronics store and just bought a standard Jiffy case that fitted what you were doing. And, you know, it still looked like something that a hobbyist created. And, you know, you create a decal and put that on the case, you know, holes for the LEDs and switches, and it still looked like something a hobbyist had done. But these days, with the amount of 3D printing and fab works that are available, you can make a very professional looking device. And I think that's where a lot of people get tricked up. It might still look very professional, but it's just a hobbyist just like you who's making it. They can't get stuck with masses of stock because now they're putting their money up front to get this done. And conversely, they don't have a just-in-time warehousing set up to take your orders and get them filled and then dispatch. So, you know, I don't like to say you got to cut them some slack. I think you just need to understand that although these people have got snazzy websites with commerce plugin behind their WordPress site, they're still just a hobbyist just like you. You need to understand that they're presenting a service back to the community. And I think as well as giving them the money for the product, I think they need our thanks and our support for actually doing it. Otherwise, all we're going to be doing is hunting around on eBay, Craigslist, or whatever, looking for secondhand equipment from 30 years ago. So, all power to them, and yes, and as soon as I see it, I buy it, because it might not be there next week.
I think the only time I would disagree maybe is there have been times over the years in retro computing where, you're right, the vendors are essentially hobbyists. It's all just us selling to ourselves, and it's great, and it is an amazingly useful thing that some people can step up and make this stuff that I could never make. So I appreciate the heck out of that, and I have personally only had great experiences so far. Everything I have purchased from a retro computing vendor has arrived and worked and been exactly as advertised. So I have lucked out completely, 100% success. But I have read about over the years lots of times, well, not lots of times, but a few times when a vendor would misrepresent something, and usually they're misrepresenting either the stock level. Like they'll say, I've got some things to sell. I've got, you know, here we go. And these are ready to go, and they're not ready to go. And then an order's placed and a year, 2 years go by and nothing is fulfilled and no money's returned. And I can see somebody saying, well, this is completely unreasonable. And those situations have come up because it's difficult to sometimes anticipate. Like you were saying, it's very difficult to anticipate the work involved in these small level runs, especially if it's your first time producing something. But when a vendor doesn't make clear the fact that the product doesn't yet exist, then I do think that is an unreasonable standard to hold somebody to, that it's okay for them to say, I'm selling a thing, and then you just never hear from them again. You know, if you take the money, then you've got to state up front, like maybe like Kickstarter, hey, I'm hoping to do a run of these things, so once I get 50 orders, I'm going to do my best. That seems totally reasonable. But there have been times a few years ago where somebody would say, I've got 20 of something available, and there weren't any. And so I think that's taking it too far. Well, I do generally agree, however, that the different, maybe we'll call it lower standard, is something that is not unreasonable to hold hobbyist vendors to. And I have personally only had great experiences.
Excellent. I'm glad you've had such a sterling record. I would say that there have been those unfortunate instances that you've heard about, if not personally encountered. And whatever our standards are, whether they're lower for retro computing or not, I think it's reasonable to have certain consistent expectations regardless of the size of the retailer you're dealing with. For example, once you give them your money, you should reasonably expect your product within a reasonable time frame. If the retailer cannot meet that time frame, they should offer a refund as an option. And throughout the entire process, as you said, Carrington, they should be communicative about the status of your order, mm-hmm. whether it's going to take an extra week, an extra month, whatever obstacles they may be encountering. It's reasonable for the customer to expect to know what that is.
Sure. If I was on Etsy buying a scarf and I gave somebody money on Etsy and then simply didn't hear from them again for 8 months, I would think it's completely reasonable to be upset about that.
I absolutely agree.
Even as a Canadian. I would be Canadian upset.
And without a scarf, you'd just be frozen.
Exactly. No, we actually lie about the cold to keep Americans out. It's balmy and beautiful here year-round.
Oh, that's not why I'm staying away from you, Carrington. Excellent. So thank you, everybody, for chiming in on the status of whether or not retro computing vendors should be held to more realistic expectations, whatever those might be. Moving on to listener feedback, we're going to save that for our next episode because we do have a full house today with 6 people on the show. So we have a lot of news to get through. Let's start by dialing into Carrington. What do you have for us?
Dial into Carrington. Carry FM. All me, all the time. World War IV WWIV, the bulletin board system, still exists and was recently updated. This was completely news to me. Like, what? What? I was never a user of it back in the day, being more of a non-PC user. So, but I'm pretty sure that this was one of the bigger PC BBSs. I think it had a rep for being sort of geared towards people who wanted to do the whole wares thing. I think Fido people got upset about them or something. Anyway, I was quite surprised to see that World War IV, or WWIV, or however it's pronounced, was very recently updated. Version 5 exists now. It's open source. You can grab it from GitHub. I just think it's super cool. So I was quite surprised that it still existed and it's still being updated.
Huh. I definitely have seen them in the, you know, the BBS lists of old, but I don't think I ever actually had experience with it at the time. Very cool, though.
Mm-hmm. I just remember that back in the FidoNet days, when BBSs were all being linked through FidoNet, there was, I think at that time, the idea that a lot of, you know, big mucky mucks in FidoNet were against the idea of having World War IV, or WWIV, which I know how it's pronounced, have their nodes all connected in because they were a bunch of wearsers, a bunch of pirates. And I think that that's the reason, I'm just guessing here, there was a big, like, sort of FidoNet competitor in a sense, which was WWIV Net, and that was just for those World War IV BBSs. So they had their own FidoNet going for a while, and I think because of that reason, there was some sort of controversy or something. I was out of that world completely. My BBSs were, I went a different way. I was just really impressed that it still exists for something back in the 80s that you can still get the essentially the same software. So pretty cool.
Cool. I hope they called it WeaveNet.
I hope so too.
Now, this software doesn't support Telnet. Is it still just dial-up?
I think the latest version does support Telnet, does it not?
Okay.
Yeah.
I actually don't know. I should have phrased that as a question.
Yep. Looks like they have, yes. The latest version includes a GUI Telnet server, a whole bunch of things. So.
Wow, you're right.
It's all modernized, and yet still looks old. It's neat, and I think it's really cool that it exists. I suspect everybody who's into it already knew about this, but it was news to me. So links are in the show notes.
Awesome. Thank you. Moving on to Earl. What are you emulating these days?
Well, a BBC Micro, as it turns out. Really interesting video on YouTube. We've talked before about the JS Mess collection of JavaScript-based emulators, and it's amazing that the browser and HTML5 and JavaScript have become fast and sophisticated enough where you can actually emulate a retro computer. If you want to know the real guts of how something like that is done, I would recommend this video on YouTube. The Video takes you through the process of developing an emulator for the BBC Micro in JavaScript. And it goes into wonderful, excruciating detail on all the pieces of that. First off, the CPU emulation, the internals of the BBC Micro, how you would craft something like this in JavaScript, and then there's actual demos of it working. And I just found this fantastic. So we'll have a link up in the show notes. If you are a BBC Micro enthusiast, I would think this is a must. But even if you're not, if you want to have an understanding of how these emulators are developed, and specifically how this newfangled stuff with JavaScript is being done, then this is a really good resource. Also, I found that the video was pretty crisp, too. You know, some of these that you watch where they're showing you screenshots and code and that kind of thing, if they're fuzzy, then it makes it a little hard to follow. But this video is also really professional quality. So thumbs up.
Very good. Nice find, Earl.
The emulator is really quite cool. I started up, there's a link in the YouTube, notes that leads to the JavaScript emulator. And I'm sitting here looking at this screen thinking, I don't remember. I had one of these for a little bit, and I would love to see the weird colors again. But I will definitely have to play with this. I don't think this is JSMS backed, right? I think this is independent.
This is independent. Right. But I was just bringing up JSMS because it's amazing, this growing set and the growing quality of retro computer emulation in a browser with JavaScript just boggles the mind.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mind boggler for sure. Let's see, Jack, what do you got for us today?
Well, I came across a link here to a new 10-line basic competition, or it's not a new competition, this has been going on for 5 or 6 years, and but they've announced the latest one. And the idea with this is you make a game using 10 lines of basic code from any of the classic 8-bit computers, and they have different sort of like categories of whether or not you're actually using it in 10 lines that are 80 characters each, or 10 lines that may be logical lines that are 120 characters, this sort of thing. You can do things like poking values. You're not allowed to have machine code that is sort of contained within a string and executed, that sort of thing. So it's got to be in BASIC. But basically, it can be for any 8-bit computer. The deadline for this is not till the end of March, so you got some time. And the winner will be announced at the NOMAM Retro Convention in the beginning of April, April 2nd. I don't know where that convention is. I tried to search just for that convention. It's not something that is talked about a whole lot. There have been a number of them over the years. It's somewhere here in Europe. That's all I'm sure of. It might be in Germany. It might be in Poland. I don't know. Anyway, it could be fun, though. It could be a fun thing to sort of dust off your basic chops and see what you can do in 10 lines of basic.
I'm sure if you just show up somewhere in Europe and ask for directions, you'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty small.
And this is a competitive time, because I believe the Winter Retro Challenge is also underway, is it not?
I believe it is.
Yeah. And was it Nibble Magazine who used to have its own 10-liners?
Were they 10 or 2?
I think you might be right about them being 2.
Yeah, Nibble had one-liner and two-liner column normally at the back of the magazine.
So it really depends on whether we're talking decimal or binary then. So you're both right.
Hooray.
Yay. Because there are 10 kinds of people in the world. Excellent. So good point, Carrington.
Yeah. I think this is awesome. I learned about this competition from Kevin Savitz. I think last year he was talking about it and entered in it.
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic, and I might actually just give it a shot.
Is there an episode of this show where we don't mention Kevin?
No. And there shouldn't be.
That's right. All right. Now that we've checked off that quota.
I see it. You can write it for any 8-bit computer system. So I think we should all write for Quindunkie's Veronica. And just submit it that way. Go there. Go get one and try to run it. Yeah, they won't know.
Is there an emulator for that computer in JavaScript?
No, but Earl's going to make one.
Okay, good.
It should definitely be a part of MAME and JSMS.
My 10-line program will include an emulator. First two lines.
It'll emulate itself.
Exactly.
When you go that time? Oh, boy. All right, so speaking of one-liners, two-liners, and Nibble Magazine, the founding publisher of Nibble Magazine, Mr. Mike Harvey, is announced as the keynote speaker for Kansas Fest 2016. The Kansas Fest is, of course, the annual Apple II convention held in Kansas City, Missouri, and it is being held this year, July 19th to the 24th. And Mr. Harvey's presentation will be the first formal official presentation of the event on Wednesday, July 20th. We previously had at this event, I think back in 2007, the founding editor, Mr. David Satella. And 2 years ago, we had Margot Comstock of Soft Talk magazine. So we have quite the accomplished lineup over the years of editors and publishers from the Apple II world. This is very exciting. I have had email communications with Mike many times over the years as the editor of Juice.js. I think it's fair to say that Juice.js and a lot of the other magazines in the Apple II world probably wouldn't exist if it were not for the precedent set by Harvey and his crew. So it's going to be very exciting to meet him. Anybody else looking forward to this event?
Oh, very
I'm
much.
Really, really looking forward to Mike Harvey as the keynote. One of my favorite sections of the Nibble magazine was actually his editorials at the start. And those are actually, he's got some of them online at his Nibble magazine website. And also his collection of editorials is available as a download of the original book. So quite interesting guy. And swapped a few emails with him over the years, and really looking forward to meeting him.
Yeah, and the magazine itself had a huge impact. At least, my perception of it at least had was that it had a huge impact on the Apple II community.
The PC as well. There was the PC hands-on, which they published as well, but predominantly Apple II and Macintosh.
I never. I think I'd seen Nibble Mac. I don't know if I've ever read it. I definitely, the Apple II was the center of my Nibble world.
Yeah. Well, the Macintosh is just a poor shadow to the Apple II anyway, so
of course,
it was never going to be that great.
Just a toy.
No, not even sanely great. Well, all right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing all of you at Kansas Fest, but in the meantime, we have the rest of the show to get through. Michael, what news have you for us?
Well, it's more of a bit of old news, but I came across a website, 81. It's hasn't been updated for a while, but it is a page of collected links for Sinclair ZX81 style computers. So good collections of emulated systems that would be the Timex Sinclair range for those in North America, and the Sinclair ZX8081 Spectrums and the like outside here in the Empire.
The Empire.
God Save the Queen?
Yep.
Not the Empire I was thinking of. I was thinking more of the Force Awakens Empire.
Somebody not so long ago, I saw some link go by of someone had recorded the Imperial March in a major key. It sounded pretty funny.
I'll have to look that up. Excellent. Let's see. Speaking of conventions in Europe, popping the stack for a bit here. Paul, we got something going on in Berlin?
We will make this link. This segue will happen. yes, in Berlin, in fact. Berlin is where? New Hampshire?
I'm sorry, there is that city in Massachusetts. Yep, moving on.
Yep. So there was I was actually unaware of this this meeting until the recordings were posted, but there's a meeting called GeekFest, I guess GeekFest Berlin. So they have recordings from the it's basically like a YouTube stream of the 2015 meeting, and I think the video is not available yet. The audio, they've taken the audio and cleaned it up and made it available here, and they have really interesting speakers. It's kind of Apple centric. But, you know, whatever, that we have never shied away from that here. But so they have five different panels. So Bruce Damer from the DigiBarn is talking in one of them. They have Andy Hertzfeld and Randy Wigginton in another one about the Apple II and Macintosh development. And I think actually... Yeah, I'm losing. Yeah, John Draper. Yeah, that's what I listened to some of it. I haven't listened to all of it, but John Draper, the Captain Crunch, he's sort of participating in hosting the thing. So he's also participating in a lot of these conversations. But it's really neat. Some of the stories are things that I have not heard before. So who else? Let's see. I should mention some more names. So Lee Felsenstein, talking about the Homebrew Computer Club and beyond. The First Software Pirates is one of the panels. Dan Kottke and some other people talking about Apple Computer, hacking, NASA, smart homes. So it's really interesting. The audio is a little bit skippy in places, but from what I understand, this is the result of actually a pretty hard cleanup process. So it sounds great compared to the source material. So I'm really actually quite interested in listening to the rest of it.
It's even better audio quality than being there. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Yeah, very cool. One of the things about audio files is that I like podcasts. I like just an RSS feed I can just subscribe to and have it show up in Overcast or Pocket Cast or whatever it is I'm using. And downloading an MP3 file and then dragging it into my mobile device just seems like such a chore. I'm so spoiled.
These are first Ken problems.
They are. To be honest, I don't think anybody else has this problem, but nonetheless, this website should accommodate me.
That's right. I'm not dragging this MP3 file over here. I'm just going to toggle in my monitor code.
That's right. That's how we do it. Anyway. So, first world problems, problems with the 25th century. Carrington, talk
about... Join these words as few steps as possible.
Strangling these segues. Tell us about the divide between now and 500 years from now and how we've bridged that gulf.
I am... in both the Star Trek and Star Wars camps. So I like both of these things. Star Wars has already been mentioned, so I will now talk about Star Trek. So I got a trio of quick links for everybody. The first is Gene Roddenberry. His computer died, and his daughter, I think it was looking to recover data from some floppy disks. Who knows what is on those disks? In fact, I think while the data has been recovered, they're still not telling anybody what was on those disks. There's a neat write-up on Macworld. Been a few write-ups in a few places, but we'll link to the Macworld one. There were, I think, 10 disks. Something like that, and they make a big deal of the fact that while a couple of the discs were in DOS, many of them were in some arcane format that you would have never heard of called CPM that was impossible to recover. I was like, okay. So, but they make a really big deal out of that.
What is the CPM you speak of?
Exactly. So the discs have been recovered. They were a data recovery service called what is it called? Drive Savers Data Recovery. Seems to have been successful in getting back the 2 to 3 megabytes total of data. Oh, there were 200 floppies. Oh my goodness. Okay. But they have been recovered. Most of them were in CPM. They are, lots of people are speculating about what's on there. It's just been said that it is not the case that is in a bunch of scripts for unproduced episodes. But who knows? But something's on there and it's been recovered. The fact that that got in the news got people talking about, well, just what the heck was this computer? Because, you see lots of photos of it. It is toured around and it's not like looking at an IBM or an Apple or a Sinclair computer with a big badge on it. It's just kind of generic. So PC World and some others tried to figure out, well, what is it in the first place? Benj Edwards took some guesses that it might be a Blackhawk. Turns out it's not really a computer. It was a dedicated word processing machine. It was called something writer is what it was called. I don't know, but it was.
Way to do your homework, Karen.
Well, you know, like, I only bring so much to the table here. I'm more about personality, to be honest.
Oh boy.
So, but it was a dedicated word processor. Did use CPM, but it was not a general purpose PC as we would think of it. So that was kind of interesting. So we're gonna have links to both of those, and then to round out the trio, I found this the most interesting of all. So recently published is an article over on swling.com or sling.com about how Bob McGuire used a Cray 2 supercomputer to decode a ham radio transmission heard in Star Trek 4. So if that headline doesn't grab you, then you are dead inside, because I think this is super awesome. So in Star Trek 4, which was the journey home, so after they have searched for Spock, they're journeying home, and there's a scene...
Voyaging, even.
They're voyaging home. Very good. Nice. So Scotty is trying to beam Chekhov and Uhura back to the Enterprise, have difficulty, and there's all this interference. And in the background... of that interference, somebody, this Bob McGuire, listens and says, I think that's ham radio stuff, and used a Cray-2 to separate the signals from the various noises and decode and figure out what the heck is that signal. It was indeed some ham radio stuff. I don't understand the ham radio terms, CF personality above, but it's a really neat write-up. And so if you're interested in ham radio stuff, or a wise-thinking person who is interested in Star Trek, then all three of these links have lots of neat photos and lots of neat info, and I like the fact that we're talking about the future of Star Trek, but both in terms of retro computing seems to be right in our wheelhouse. All links will be in the show notes.
So what did the transmission say?
It was,
more Ovaltine?
I'll read you the bit. Maybe, is anybody here? Earl, I think you're a ham radio person, right?
Yeah, I'm one of them.
Okay.
Not just a ham.
So it was WA8ZCN0 sending an RR for NR3 to N6AEZ on 20 meters. So, Ken, I hope you are glad you asked. That's what it was. None of those terms mean anything to me.
It's just a couple of call signs and a conversation. And also the SWL is shortwave listening. So SWLing is shortwave listening.
See, that's why we invite Earl. Drop of the knowledge.
So one of you brings the knowledge, the other brings the personality.
Exactly. Earl and I together become a whole person.
You complete him, Earl.
I'm so happy about this.
We all need our purpose. How lucky that you found yours. Wow, that is excellent. As you said, Star Wars has been in the news a lot lately, so it's nice to see some Star Trek, especially this year being the 50th anniversary of the original series debut in 1966.
All that said, in about 2.5 hours, I'm going to go see Star Wars again.
And how many times will this make? This will
make my third.
Nice. Wow, only three, huh?
Yeah,
it is a really good movie.
I agree. It's awesome.
Yeah. Even if it is the same movie that came out in 77.
I think that's the nature of this myth. That things get recycled. I'm totally okay with it. It's great.
Oh, yeah, me too. And I don't mean to say it's a ripoff at it by any means. They're doing a lot of original stuff and laying a great groundwork for future movies. But it's important to acknowledge that a lot of this stuff is familiar.
Yep. Oh, they tried. They tried. It's a. You look at this and you think, oh, why are you making it so blatant that you're doing exactly this thing and exactly the same time? But
yeah. Because they had to make up for the prequels.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, at least this movie demonstrates that Star Wars is being helmed by somebody who understands what makes Star Wars so great.
Or at least somebody who had seen the first three movies.
Right. But yeah. Also somebody who doesn't mind lens flares every now and then. I noticed the J.J. Abrams signature was all over the movie, but that's not a bad thing, by the way.
I actually didn't notice that.
I thought he reined it in quite a bit.
All right. Well, we don't have to wait for the movie theater a long time ago in a galaxy far away for a war across the stars. We have global thermonuclear war happening right here. Tell us about it, Earl.
We do. We mentioned a little bit ago that the Retro Challenge is in progress. In fact, it goes through the month of January, so it's half over already. And there's a lot of interesting projects. We will have a link in the show notes in case you're interested in going and looking at some of the blogs. But I'll just highlight a couple of the ones that caught my eye. One is indeed global thermonuclear war. Who would have known that a couple of color computers talking to each other over IRC could trigger the end of civilization? I guess maybe at some level we all knew that. But that's one of the projects that you'll find over there. Also, another head-to-head kind of battle, maze war, between an Olivetti M10 versus an NEC PC8201A. You know, both of those with the little LCD screens, very much like the Radio Shack Model 100. And they're in a no-holds-barred death match. I'm trying to make this as exciting sounding as I can.
I don't know, Earl. I think I recall seeing a head-to-head one once before, between Apple versus Commodore. Ring a bell? Who won that again?
That sounds very familiar. I think moving. We were manually inputting that, though. It might have been more fun if we could have them talk to each other over the network, but then one might be Colossus and the other Guardian and... You know what happens there.
They start playing chess and that's the end of the world.
Exactly. The last thing here is basic programming on the Tandy MC10. It's a computer that's near and dear to my heart. I used to have one. Loved that little booger. And there's lots of great screenshots in this blog. And I think some YouTube demos also. So that's what's going on in the Retro Challenge. People are having fun. They're posting, they're tweeting, they're retroing. And so somebody out there, pay attention.
Awesome. I've never been one to enter these competitions. I used to do Hackfest at Kansas Fest back in the day, and I lost my mojo at some point and just never got it back. So I don't know that I have the discipline necessarily to enter Retro Challenge either, because...
You don't need discipline for Retro Challenge.
I know.
In fact, it's almost a disqualifying attribute.
I can imagine. I mean, Kansas Fest has the structure of you have to do it in this very specific geographic space during a very constrained time frame of 1 week, and people will be literally looking over your shoulder to judge you. None of that is true for Retro Challenge.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. It's very loosely organized. I mean, they used to say it was a loosely organized contest where you could do something with a retro computer and maybe win crappy prizes. And that was their marketing material. So I think you don't really need the discipline. You just need to get in and have fun. And that's what we do all the time. So
Ken, you've entered and won Hackfest before, didn't you, at Kansas Fest?
Not since it moved to Rockhurst like 11 years ago. It's been a while.
Yeah, you did some sort of Napster thing, right?
I did a couple of different things. One year I did a Boggle game. The other year I did a database script for Spectrum that would open up AppleWorks databases, and another year I did a Napster client. Yeah, so those were my three that showed best. But those were like in the late 90s, early aughts.
Yep.
You know, back when I was young, before I lost my skill. Oh, well.
Carrington's done well at Hackfest, though.
Oh, yes.
I've entered once, I've won, I'll never enter again, so I can remain champion.
I remember how insulted you looked when you won.
I think I was more than I was surprised, because there was one of the projects that hadn't been talked about yet in the announcing of the winners, which was Kevin's. I had assumed, well, that's got to be in the top three, so he must have won. So it was more, I was shocked. I was like, me? What? Cool.
Fine, I was insulted that you won. All right, moving on. Jack, you have something for us from the world of Atari.
I do. This is something that popped up lately. The discussion happening here in the Atari Age Forum is actually from December and November. But it's a very cool thing. It's being called the Atari Game Designer. And what this is actually a set of... basically sort of a library for doing drawing of software sprites and other things in a kind of a peculiar, not commonly used graphics mode on the Atari 8-bits. Basically, this allowed for 9 colors on screen at a weird resolution of like 80 by 192. So the pixels are not square at all. They're very sort of elongated. But the cool thing is, there's some videos on here you can click through and see that show a whole bunch of multicolored sort of sprites moving around independently. Now, they're not actually sprites. It's just kind of redrawing the whole screen each time through. But it's very different from the way traditional Atari 8-bit graphics look. And there's a lot of discussion here about saying, hey, maybe we could make a Pengo game with this sort of thing as the foundation and that sort of stuff. So there's an interesting sort of... It's very different from, again, the way typical Atari 8-bit games look and work because of this weird graphics mode that it's using. So if you're curious about this, take a look. It looks pretty interesting. I've not yet... downloaded the stuff and tried it out. It is kind of an open source thing. I think he said he's working on Linux. It will probably work reasonably well on other platforms as well. So
I will fully support anything that brings us Pengo. I love that game.
More Pengo for the people.
Yay. Awesome. Speaking of which, I'm headed up to FunSpot like 2 weeks from right now. I'm going to be up at the world's largest video game arcade in Laconia, New Hampshire. So excited. Nice. You're all welcome to join me.
Yep. Why are you going there? I mean, there's other than that, it's awesome.
Because it's awesome. I go there twice a year, once in the winter and once on Labor Day.
I have never been. I really want to go.
I know. You're welcome. And it's only like a 20-hour drive for you?
Yeah. For you, 20 hours.
It's what, like an hour?
It's about 2 hours from here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we usually stop at Pinball Wizard in Pelham, New Hampshire on the way back.
Oh, there's got to be a twist.
A twist?
Stay with me, Ted. Pinball Wizard.
Oh, you know what? Never actually seen the show. Sorry.
That's anyway. That's the twist.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I think it's best that we just move on. Hey, I'm up next. Speaking of games, we have the Video Game Hall of Fame, hosted by the International Center for the History of Electronic Games at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. They are seeking nominations for their 2016 inductees. Now, this is a form you can fill out to suggest a game that should be recognized for its icon status, longevity, geographical reach, and influence. And there is a, so it's not just you punch in your name and you say, hey, I really like Lode Runner, and that's the end of the story. Last year they inducted, I believe, 6 games, those being World of Warcraft, Tetris, the original Super Mario Brothers, Pong, Pac-Man, and Doom. Now, you can quibble over those games as much as you like. They are, however, very important to the evolution of gaming. The main quibble I have is that none of them originated on the Apple II. Several of them had appearances on the Apple II, of course, Pac-Man, Pong, Tetris, not World of Warcraft, as far as I can recall. But I think it's time that the Apple II be recognized, and there's one person who would agree with that, and that is Nina Smith, who is the daughter of Douglas E. Smith, the creator, of course, of Lode Runner. Doug Smith, unfortunately, passed away in 2014, which, Paul, you did a great tribute to that. You used the Lode Runner level editor to create an image thanking him for all his work, and thank you again for letting us publish that in Juice.js. Yeah. That was a really great piece you did. And Nina Smith wants to recognize her father's work by getting Lode Runner inducted into the Video Game Hall of Fame, and regardless of who created the game or whether or not it's a tribute to its creator, I agree that Lode Runner is a fantastic game and deserves to be recognized for all the reasons she indicated. It's a game that continues to be played to this day in a variety of iterations, sequels, platforms, and formats, mobile, desktop, console, and etc. And I think it's a really good game that deserves to be in there. Now, there are, of course, other possibilities like Prince of Persia, Karateka. No, I'm sorry, I mispronounced that. Karateka, is that correct?
Karateka.
Karateka.
What you said. Oregon Trail. You know, there are so many possibilities, and you can nominate as many as you like. But I would, I'm definitely going to take a moment and think about how I want to phrase a nomination for Lode Runner and submit that. Anybody else have any other nominations that they're going to submit?
Well, I have a question about the process.
Yeah.
Is it just, this is not voting, right? This is just nominating. Is there later a round of voting based on the nominations? Like, does Lode Runner need to get nominated 100 times, or does once suffice?
I'm pretty sure that the final selection comes from the curators of The Strong. Let me pull up some details on that. Let me see if I can find out.
That should be our new name, The Curators of the Strong.
Wow, what a great title. That'd be awesome.
If we move to a weekly format, then we can be the Curators of the Strong Weekly.
Curators of the Week.
The Weekly Strong? There you go. It's the final decision is made by journalists, scholars, and other industry professionals. So, for example, last year, from all the nominations, they boiled down to a list of 15, which did include Oregon Trail, Minecraft, Legend of Zelda, Space Invaders, Sonic the Hedgehog, The Sims, and others.
Never heard of any of those.
I know, right? I think people are just making stuff up for the ballot. So it's not a popularity contest. It is not a online voting process that can be rigged.
Accepted.
There's your retro challenge.
That would be awesome. My retro challenge. I'm going to rig the nominations.
Hey, if you can do it, I'll vote for that. So anyway, I hope that answers your question as best as we're able, Paul.
Sure. Yep.
Cool. All right. Moving on. Michael, you have something from the C64 world.
Yes. One of my favorite pastimes is reading, and I might as well be reading about retro computers. So here are two latest issues from the Commodore world. So we have the Commodore Free Magazine, issue 90 is out. And then there's also KNA Plus, Issue 3 is out on there. Both are good reads, unless English is not your strong suit. I recommend the English download for K&A Plus. But both good reads. Read them cover to cover and found it a few interesting bits and pieces for the Commodore. And I think it's actually almost reaching that threshold stage where I'm going to have to get a C64 that works onto my main desk here.
Excellent.
Excellent, says Earl. His fingers together. Ah, excellent.
Well, Kansas Fest is opening up to more and more platforms. I'm sure you'll continue to be welcome, Michael.
I love the footnote that I felt on the end of that. Okay.
I'd quibble with the word continue.
There's that. Anyway, let's see. We're coming down to the home stretch of the news. Let's hear what we have from Paul.
Okay, so I just saw this announced recently, so I think it's new news. The maker of the floppy Emu has a new Model B out. So it's got, the floppy Emu is a generally a compact or like a flash device that works on pretty much any Apple product that has this, I think it's a 19-pin connector for disk connections, so it'll boot original Macs, it'll work on Apple IIs, and so the Model B has a couple of enhancements. It's a little bit more protected power-wise, so that you're not as likely to fry it by plugging it into the wrong thing, and it has the both Mac and Apple II firmware on board already, so you don't have to, with the current one, you have to flash a new firmware every time you want to move from machine to machine. But this thing is amazing, though. I mean, this one little device that can power all of your machines. I've started a Lisa on it, in fact. But anyway, so the Floppy Emu Model B is available, and so take a look at that. We'll have a link. And the remaining stock of Floppy Emu Model A is being sold off slightly cheaper. So if you were, you know, I don't know, it's not that, the price is not that much different, but if you wanted to get a slight bargain, you can get the Model A as well until he runs out. So.
And how much do those cost?
The Model A is being sold now for $95 and the Model B for $109.
I've only heard great things about this.
Mm. No, they're excellent devices. I've played with one, and now if I can actually switch firmware on the device rather than reflashing it before I use it, it'll be good, because at the moment I would need this for a 128K and a 512K Mac, as well as Apple II machines. And if I can basically be, you know, using the one device, I'm not really prepared to get one for each of the four machines that I want to use it on. So if I can move it between the two groups, that'd be great. But this mm-hmm. is an excellent device. I've loved reading his blog over the years as he's been developing it. From some of the original ideas that were proposed in the 68kmla.org website, and then through to his blog. It's a great piece of engineering and software development.
The one other thing too, that I forgot to mention, is that the flash card, the reason I sort of stumbled when I was talking about what flash technology it uses is because the Model B uses a different one. It now has micro SD support, so it'll be easy to get the media.
Okay, so if you have a CFFA 3000, does the Floppy Emu do much that's unique?
Mm-hmm. Starts your Mac.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? I only have an Apple II, so I was stuck thinking of it that way. But you're right. Yeah. This does a lot more than that.
The main thing is it's a drive emulator. So rather than the CFFA, which is more of a drive emulator and productivity tool. So, you know, this one, you need to have your disk images and put them onto it, as opposed to using it to extract them from a physical floppy media. Mm. But no, it's a very nice device. It's got a good little LCD screen for choosing the disk that you want to load from the images that are on the SD card. And I think most importantly is that it's now designed for hot swapping the SD card while it's hooked up and running. So I believe some people were a bit surprised when they found out. They thought, oh, I could do that on the previous model, but it wasn't guaranteed, and there were a few instances of power spikes from when the card was inserted. So this is all, as Paul was saying, it's got extra protection circuits on it, and it's probably going to be coming down under fairly soon.
Very good. Well, that looks like it may be the end of our news segment. Does anybody want to pick up some spares?
I think we should at least mention John Romero, who released a new version of, or a new level for Doom, a revised version of the last level for episode one of Doom. Like, how amazing is that? I'll tell you how amazing. Very much so.
I heart John Romero so much. He is such a fan of the retro computing community. He, you know, he saved Bob Bishop's estate when it was going to be thrown out. He pops into the Apple II enthusiast group and sends stuff to us. He re-released Dangerous Day from the Apple II to iOS. He wrote for the latest issue of Juice GS. He is such a great guy.
Yep. And that hair.
I know. And now, a word from somebody else's sponsor.
Well, it's a program that I developed with a friend of mine in San Francisco. And it's called the Verbicizer. It'll take the sentence and I'll divide it up between the columns. And then when I've got, say, 3 or 4 or 5, sometimes I go as much as 20, 25 different sentences going across here. And then I'll set it to randomize. And it'll take those 20 sentences and cut in between them all the time, picking out, choosing different words from different columns and from different rows of sentences. So what you end up with is a real kaleidoscope of meanings and topics and nouns and verbs, all sort of slamming into each other. Save. The choices that I now make from this form, I can then re-imbue it with an emotive quality if I want to, or take it as it writes itself. So, I mean, some of the things I'll empathize with terrifically. It's almost like a technological dream in its own way. It creates the images from a dream state without having to go through the boredom and going to sleep all night.
People have either really accepted what I do or they absolutely sort of push it away from them. And I guess I've gotten used to that, and that's kind of, I guess that's what I am, you know. Sometimes I'm useful currency and other times I'm not.
The voice you just heard was the late David Bowie. In 1993, Grace Note CTO and co-founder Ty Roberts created software for Mr. Bowie called Verbicizer, which allowed him to basically get assistance in creating lyrics for his songs. And that excerpt is from a 4-minute video, which is on YouTube. Links are in the show notes. Godspeed, Mr. Bowie. On a happier note, it's time for the retro computing gift idea, and that is the host responsibility, which I guess makes it mine. And what I'm asking for this Christmas, oh, too late, is the Matthias Tactile 3 Pro keyboard. Now, this is obviously an external USB keyboard that Mr. Andrew Plotkin, an interactive fiction author who I've backed on Kickstarter, said about it 5 years ago. If your typing doesn't sound like a hailstorm on a tin roof, you're not typing. And that comes right from the title of this product, the Tactile Pro. I think so many keyboards nowadays just don't really have a lot of satisfying tactile and even audible feedback when you're pounding on it and clacking away at it. And especially with iPhones and iPads, there are no physical keyboards, so you really don't know if you're pushing the right or wrong button until it's too late. I would love to have a honking big external keyboard that I can just pound away on, and it's been so long since I've had one like that I would like somebody to get me the Matthias Tactile Pro 3 keyboard.
I have one. They're great.
Really? How is it?
I like it. It's loud. I don't...
Is it like a hailstorm?
It does indeed. So it's just like that. I actually use my... I have a IBM Model M model, whatever it is, the, that I use more frequently, I think. But they're very similar feels, and the Tactile Pro is great. It's a really good keyboard. I had no issues with it at all. Works great, sounds great, like it.
Mm. I'm sorry, you said the Model M?
I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, Model M.
Is that also from Matthias?
No, that's the old IBM, you know, stick it in a dishwasher to clean it.
Oh, IBM, okay. Clickety-clack. Gotcha.
Yeah, so, when I'm on a iPad, I'll just say the word clack 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 when I'm typing, which makes me very popular in places like Starbucks.
Which is why you're no longer welcome there. Aw, poor Carrington.
I think that also works on the Atari 400.
I think that's beep 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 beep
saying
beep,
clack
beep.
As you type at it. You mean?
Yep.
I think that works on pretty much anything, Paul.
Yeah, I used to use a Apple Macintosh extended keyboard 2 at work using a ADB to USB adapter, and it was suggested that I might like to not use that keyboard at work.
I had a, when I was, I don't know when this was, long time ago, or high school, I worked at a data entry company, a legal publishing company, but I was in the sort of like data entry part. I was typing in legal cases or whatever. And so this put me in a room of, it was probably like, I don't know what, like 10 by 20, workstations, all with these keyboards, you know, and like super fast typists there, you know, like being paid by the word. So it was really quite something. I don't know, audio environment.
Did they ever fall into sync?
Soothing.
Where it was all of these tied together and the building starts to shake? Or maybe they'd cancel each other out. Like, just the way where you said, if you're in the exact right place, you can hear nothing.
That would be cool. But no, I never experienced that.
No.
Well, and if you want, I want to point out, if you want one of the buckling spring keyboards, you can still get those too over at Unicomp. So PCKeyboard.com, they sell the buckling spring. They had made some of the mechanisms for IBM and a number of other manufacturers, mm-hmm. and you can buy them in a variety of styles.
Cool.
Excellent. And with that gift out of the way, let's move on to the eBay auctions. Carrington, what are you bidding on these days?
I am a fan of Daisy Wheel printers. This I looked up this because of the Gene Roddenberry link from previous, where his assistant was saying he used that old, turns out not computer, for quite a while, had a Daisy Wheel printer, but then, in her word, upgraded to a dot matrix. Now, I have always preferred the Daisy Wheel. I thought of the dot matrix being great, and it's vintage, and they're wonderful, and they have that the versatility of using dots, so you can do graphics and all that. But I never really considered them an upgrade from a Daisy Wheel. I love a Daisy Wheel. Love them, love them, love them. And there's one that I have some experience with, actually, on eBay at the moment. And so, and I think it's a decent price for one. It's $100, which you think would be a lot for an old printer, but these old Daisy Wheels, especially if you don't want a really big one, I prefer the letter size ones. They're harder to come by. So there's a nice still in box, looks brand new, to be honest, Blue Chip D20, which is, I think, a very, very good one. Advertises Apple and Commodore and IBM compatibility right on the box. Comes in the box, has most of its bits and bobs still look to be sealed, and pretty decent international shipping price, $44 or so to get it up to Canada. So I think it's a reasonable deal, if not an excellent one. But for a really nice looking, clean, almost new in box Daisy Wheel, and I think one of the better models. So that is what I'm selecting.
Very nice.
Well done, sir. See, moving on, we have Earl. What do you have for us today?
Well, the product itself isn't really all that interesting. It's a 8088 chip and a socket with a couple of TTL 74 series chips on it. But the interesting thing about this board is that it comes from Seattle Computer Products from back in the day. And as you'll remember, Tim Patterson at Seattle Computer Products wrote the DOS that was then bought up by Microsoft and transmogrified into PC DOS that they then made a insane and terrible fortune on. But I would love to have a piece of history from Seattle Computer Products. I don't buy many things from my retro collection that are just a keepsake. Most of the things that I get, I like to actually have functioning and doing something. But this is one of those things that I'd consider buying just as a conversation piece.
So you would like mount it over your mantle?
Yeah, exactly.
I can't imagine what your house must look like, Earl.
Yeah, and you don't want to. That's just a reality you don't want to dream of.
I wouldn't mind a YouTube tour. I think that could go viral.
Maybe it'd get me up to 1,000 Twitter followers. I've got 998, and it's killing me.
Oh, I'm going to go unsubscribe from you right now.
Go!
All right, Jack, there's a little something that we need to help get eBay rid of because they have too many of them.
Yeah, someone is selling too many Atari 2600 cartridges. I mean, that's not what the title says. I'm saying it's too many. Someone has 98 Atari games, and all of them are either Combat or Defender or Asteroids. So they're like the most common games out there. Like they're the games that like you can't sell, really, because everybody who has an Atari 2600 has these. And clearly, so it says, normal wear, various conditions, blah, blah, all have price tags on back that come off easily. And one picture shows the price tag. So apparently these were all at a store called McKay Books, CDs, Movies, and More, and cost $1.95 each. Or maybe that's not dollars. Maybe it's €1.95. I don't know. Probably dollars, though.
They weren't buried in Alamogordo?
These were not buried. These were in some sort of used video game store that, surprise, surprise, couldn't sell 70 copies of Combat.
But for 99 cents, like, come on.
Yeah. So the whole lot of 98 of these is currently, as a starting bid, is 99 cents. And it goes on 6 days from now. So we'll see what happens before a week from now. And so the only interesting thing about this, well, there are two things. One, it's kind of fun to sort of look and see the slight variation in the labels and stuff, which is very, very slight. But the more interesting thing, like if you actually wanted to, say, make your own 2600 game and actually put it on cartridges, here's a good source of a bunch of like actual hardware to stick the things onto.
You advocate the destroying of retro material.
When it is the Combat cartridge. Combat. Yes.
I like Combat.
Me too.
Well, sure, but there are just so many of them.
The Kansas Fest committee could buy this up and everybody gets a free Atari game.
Oh, Kevin would love that.
Kevin should buy these up and just give them all out. Just be going around advocating Atari. That's three mentions for Kevin.
Business card.
So.
There's one Combat in there that has a art cover.
Yep.
Interesting.
I bet that one is worth 2 cents more than the others.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, I see that. That's interesting.
Yep.
Yeah, so this the current like the weirdest, price, it's about a penny a piece.
It's like one of those memory games, though, it looks like.
Yeah.
Like Concentration?
Yeah. Except that one Combat thing is going to mess you up.
Or you take one out, and then you have to sort of move everything around to get the one from one end to the other.
Exactly.
Oh, my God, I hate those.
Yep.
Okay.
They could have arranged this so that the Defender cartridges spelled out something.
That would have been more fun. It is kind of, it's kind of like they clustered them together, but not in
They could have made them in the shape of the Atari Fuji or something like that. They could have put some little effort in for the dollar.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm getting my money's worth.
Oh, hey, there are two of those Combats with art on them.
Oh, now they're less rare.
The Concentration game works, though.
Yay.
Buy the lot, destroy one.
I think I'm going to buy these and bury them in a landfill for 30 years. Then they'll be valuable.
There you go.
I could do a whole documentary.
That could be something somebody starts doing, just buying up old Atari stuff and just constantly making landfills out of it.
I do like the idea of this is a source for homebrew cartridges, though. That's I have a thing for an Aquarius, which is a like a multi-ROM cart thing, except that I don't have a case for it. This would not do for that, but I sort of sympathize with the need for just kind of like disposable cases.
Yep.
Excellent. It'll be interesting to see what comes of this lot, not only who buys it, but what they do with it. Moving on, my eBay selection for this week is The Big Tip Book for the Apple II series. This is published by Beagle Bros, and it has Burt Kersey and Bill Sanders' names right on the cover. According to the auction, this is a 241-page book containing many programming tips and tricks, plus shortcuts and programming strategies. And it does say rare in the title, but he goes on to describe in the subject that it is very hard to find, that they could not find one anywhere else for sale on the internet.
But there's another one on eBay right now.
There's another one on eBay right now. Of course there is. That's how rare it is. Is it from the same person?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. That's how hard it is to find. Is that it's right in your own backyard. You just have to look. I don't know this book in particular. I do have some other programming books, not from Beagle Bros. I've reviewed a few for Juiced.js years and years ago. And I'm interested in what sort of programming would be in this book. It says that it has some AppleSoft tips for memory and speed, machine language, disks, and DOS. And then it just goes on to sort of just throw out random technology terms in the hopes that something will mean something to somebody.
It does also say that it has useful two-liners. It actually has as a bullet point, two-liners, programming at its best.
Yay!
Excellent. So, in fact, actually, the book itself is scanned at beagle.applearchives.com, which is also itself kind of a fun site. It's a, I think it's a Call Apple-related endeavor.
Yes.
But it's the Beagle Brothers software repository.
Yes, so. That is definitely the work of Bill Martins and Brian Weiser. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So why buy it for $49.99 plus free shipping from Citrus Heights, California, when you can just download it for free?
Well, you can't hold it then.
But you can print it out. Go bind it, and you'll apply a little bit of spine damage, you know, un-retrobrite it, and boom. It all depends on what your time is worth. Moving on. So, Michael, you have a very sharp selection that is recently expired, but is worth mentioning anyway.
Yeah, well, I was looking for retro calculators, and I found this one, and I don't think you could actually get a better combination or hybrid mashup, whatever you want to call it, of digital age calculator and pre-digital age calculator. So what we have here is a Sharp EL8048 abacus calculator. So on the left, you've got your ye olde LCD screen digital button calculator. And over on the right, you've got even ye oldier. You've got your Soroban abacus calculator. It is a beautiful little piece, and I would love to have one of these in my retro collection, right there beside a slide rule. So, guys, have you ever seen anything quite so mashed up as this one?
Kind of reminds me of a VHS Blu-ray combo player.
Yeah, this is. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's intended to be functional, but it is very, it's very conversation sparking. It's very nice.
So I was just wondering, does the abacus work if the battery's flat?
Well, it works as an abacus.
But if you push the button, how do the beads move?
I don't think the beads move. I'm pretty sure you are overestimating the capabilities of this thing.
I think your expectations are a little too high, Michael.
It is super awesome.
How awesome would that be if you could type things in and, like, the abacus, the beads would actually move at your command?
Yeah.
No, that is the project to make.
Yeah, direct output to screen or to abacus.
And it has holes in the back, so you can actually fully use the abacus like as you would. it's very nice.
Yeah. The things you find on eBay, and then they run away.
I'm definitely going to keep my eye out.
I've already gone and put this one in as a permanent watch. If I see one of these, it's not going to be on the eBay section of this show.
Well, there. Yeah.
The Sharp LC Mate.
So, Paul, what do you have for us?
I will tell you in a moment. the reason I'm stalling here is just because I could have sworn that the it might have in fact been in the ad for the last episode, but the first small portable calculator I think was also called the LC. Anyway, someone can go back and listen to the ad and try to remember. So what I have a couple things. I will try to go through them quickly, but there is a PET 2001. -8, and it is really shiny. It is really nice looking. So the guy who's selling it doesn't know. It came from some estate, you know. Saw other ones sold for a lot, so maybe his is worth something. And I think it is. It's very old. It's in great condition. I don't think it's been turned on, but or at least I think there was an attempt. Oh yeah, there's no fuse, and that's where the attempt stopped. But at any rate, it looks very nice. It's got the Chiclet keyboard and the built-in data set. Very nice.
It's a beautiful computer, but I do prefer the other keyboard on the slightly lighter PETs. I love the PET industrial design, though. The form factor is just one of the all-time greats.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
But that keyboard would be a nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, and the ones with the Chiclet keyboard are very collectible. They're just not very pleasant to use. But if this works, and by the way, with it not having a fuse, they were smart to not get one and just willy-nilly turn it on, because, you know, who knows why that fuse blew. But in the right hands, I think this would wind up probably doubling or tripling the bid that it's up to right now. Currently, it's going for $107 US.
Are those right hands your hands?
Not. Nope. I wouldn't want one of these. They just I used one of these in high school, and the memory is enough.
You can always, except the memory, you can never have enough memory.
It sounds like therapy.
Except it doesn't have enough memory.
Right. I actually just quite recently got a cursor uncrasher tube switch thing for a pet, which is I've seen an ad in an old magazine for this, but it's basically a little switch that you wire into a pet to serve as a reset button. So if you're, you know, computer goes off the deep end. Like an Apple II has a reset button. The pet does not. So to save your power, you know, your power supply from having to be cycled on and off all the time, I've got a little thing. I'll put a link in there for that.
I think that's because the Commodore users didn't need a reset button. They didn't make that many mistakes with their code.
Of course.
That's they made the mistake in purchase.
No. So, okay. Anyway, what else? I came across I don't know why this is interesting, but someone was selling a Palm 7, and I thought, oh, Palm 7, I had one of those. In fact, actually, what I had was the Palm 7, it's, you know, it's a buy it now for $8, you know, so it doesn't really cost very much. This particular auction that I'm linking to has the cable, the cradle, the Palm 7, and a Palm portable keyboard, which is kind of a cool thing because it folds in four segments and sort of accordions out. These are like the thing about the Palm 7, the Model 7 of this line, was that it had a wireless connection. It was actually sort of connected to a sort of internet, and so extra useless now. But it was a pretty cool development at the time. So I'm sort of separately going to link to a Palm 7X, which has a little bit more, you know, oomph to it, so that you can not connect to anything with more memory. But as it turns out, so I had one of these, and I was trying to remember, like, why do I have one of these? It seems like it would have been a weird thing for me to get in a way. But I won it in 2001 on Handigo, the one of the Palm software marketers. Apparently I just won a contest, and so they sent me a Palm 7X. So I did in fact connect to the internet with the on PalmNet with these little web clipping applications while riding the train. Okay, and then the last thing I'll just mention is there are two things. I will mention them both. One is a LabVolt 6502 microcomputer trainer. It's not one of the famous ones like a Kim or a Sim or it's a little bit more like the Heathkit ET3400, but it's 6502. It has a lot of, you know, sort of places to connect. I was going to look this up and didn't, but it has a couple of, I think, 50-pin connectors, which may or may not be mappable to the connectors that an Apple II uses, but at any rate, it's a 6502 and looks pretty cool. So.
That is cool looking. I have one question about this thing specifically.
Yeah, the
lower
ignition?
Left corner of this thing, there's a keyhole.
Yeah, key. Yeah. Key ignition, is it?
Yeah, and I've seen a couple of pictures of this, a couple of different instances of this trainer, and they have a key, and I've never seen the key with it. So,
well, in the early 6502s had a starter motor.
That's right.
Ah,
it's the ignition bit.
So when Paul says he's going to take one of these to Kansas Fest, he literally means he's going to take it to Kansas Fest, start it up, and ride it.
Ride it.
Yep. And the last thing I wanted to point out, actually, it seems like kind of a neat thing. It's a classic Mac cover. It's a new made thing. It's not vintage, but it actually has, I think it may be hand embroidered, in fact, but it has a little Apple logo on it, and it fits over the you know, like the 128 and the Mac SE and that sort of form Mac too. I don't know, protect it from yellowing and dust.
I love it. So. I miss computer covers, and I think this is one of the nicest ones I've seen for a toaster Mac. I have an SE30, and I'm actually thinking I might pick up one of these covers for as long as they can be sold with the Apple logo embroidered on there and having nothing to do with the company. I think it's really nice looking.
Yeah, I like it. Right now there are there were 8. 2 have sold. There are 6 left. They are $32 for at least in the U.S. free shipping.
So. Very nice. Thank you, Paul. And that brings us to the end of the eBay discussions, which means that we are wrapping up the show. We have a few last notes. Would anybody like to start, such as Carrington?
I got notes, just a couple of quick things, because I haven't been on the show in 6 or 7 decades, so some old stuff that I think is still worth mentioning. The first would be Mighty Micro. I'd never heard of it before, but there was a British TV show in the late 70s, 79, I think, called Mighty Micro. I think I had more to say about it before for earlier shows, but didn't happen. Still think the link's worth putting in the show notes, because it's a fun show, and there's a neat write-up about it, and you can watch episodes online. That's super fun. We were talking earlier about clicky keyboards, and so that's why I think I should leave these links as well. A while ago, I stumbled across something called Deskthority, sort of like the Desk Authority, and they have thousands, over 1,000 articles about bits and bobs to do with computers. Like, so it will be, let's have an article about particular keycaps and their shapes and how they changed over time on a particular model of a particular keyboard, and to know which was made during what month and in what factory. So if you're looking for bizarrely detailed information about keyboard buckling springs and variants and ELPs versus other sorts of switches or that sort of thing, it's an amazingly detailed site and a neat reference. Let's throw both of those links into the show notes. So hooray for those. Oh, I also should give a shout out to SpaceX, because the Falcon 9 launches today. And I think I'm hoping that goes well. I'm excited about that. I love that we're living in a time where rockets are once again launching and doing cool stuff.
Yay.
Yeah, they're going to launch it, put a satellite into orbit, and then land on a boat in the Pacific.
I mean, wow.
How awesome is that? So
that is impressive.
Yes, I will find a link to that and throw that for the show notes as well.
The future is now. Amazing. And Earl, you have something for us.
Yeah, a couple episodes ago, we talked about the Myst computer, which is an FPGA-based hardware device that emulates through configurable cores a variety of our old machines, Commodore, Amiga, the Atari ST, the Atari 8-bits, and a bunch of the old gaming consoles as well. Anyway, in the conversation, we talked a bit about FPGAs and doing circuit designs for those and how that would be something fun to learn. So one of the listeners to RCR, Bob, got in touch with me and he said, hey, I've got a spare FPGA development board, and if you'd like it, I'd be happy to give it to you. And I thought, what a wonderful gift. So I took him up on his offer, and it arrived, and I've buried myself playing with it. I mean, I don't even think my family's seen me for a few days here. But I'm really enjoying learning about FPGAs, learning about one language in particular that you use to design the circuits called Verilog. And I'm very excited about how FPGAs can interface with modern electronic doodads like the Arduino and the propeller chip, and also all the retro computer potential applications that there are for this. I mean, you can basically take one of these FPGAs and tell it, hey, be this processor. No, be this other processor. And it'll just change its brain to do those things. You're actually programming it at the hardware gate level. So anyway, special shout out to Bob, and I'm having a lot of fun, so I thought I'd share it here.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you, Earl. And last thing before we close up for the day is we have to announce the winner of our retweeting competition, if you can call it that. So Woo-hoo. We invited everybody who listened to episode 117, or at least saw our tweet about it, to retweet, and one random retweeter will be selected to win a 2016 subscription to quarterly Apple II magazine Juice GS, courtesy Juice GS. So the way we've done this is I've taken all the people who retweeted in, I believe, chronological order, and have put them in a spreadsheet, given each person a number, and I have shared this spreadsheet with Carrington so that we have redundancy, oversight, people knowing that I'm not just picking the person I like.
Because it's good to share.
Isn't it? Now, one thing I did not anticipate in this competition is that there are bots out there that scan for the words retweet to win, and they just retweet. I was not counting on that.
Yeah, but if you just denounce the winner and don't post the winner, then that screws the bots.
Perhaps, but I still think we should perhaps reach out to the winner. And I
don't
want to... Well, yeah. I don't want to put myself in the position of deciding who's a person and who's a bot.
I do.
It's possible that the bot might like Juice GS.
That's true. And so we're going to select a winner with no discrimination, and if they don't collect their prize, we may be back in 2 weeks to choose a different winner. But in the meantime, Paul, I'm going to ask you to choose a random number between 1 and 33.
Or a really big number.
Oh, you excluded 37. But... 37 is the most random number.
Unfortunately, that's not
I think you can look that up.
Yeah, but you could. This, but... 37 mod 33 would give
3.7.
Us 4, and you'd add 1, so 5.
One whole number, please, between from 1 to 33, including those numbers.
All right. 18.
18. The winner is Snish Heroics or not him. So congratulations. We'll be reaching out to you with your prize.
That's totally a bot.
Yeah, I know.
Every single thing this person has tweeted, person in quotes, is a retweet to win.
I think they retweeted this actually 3 times. Should we choose a second person just in case?
Yes.
Yes.
So, Paul, what's another number?
Another number is 22.
And that would be Martin de Curtins. So
sound like
maybe
a bot,
we'll...
Martin.
Is that another bot?
No.
Okay. So hopefully we'll have something for you next time. We'll see. But in the meantime, let's see. So that is it for RCR Podcast, episode number 118 for January 17th, AD 2016. You can find all the show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. And you're welcome to discuss this particular episode on Twitter with us in the conversation at RCR Podcast, or in the Vintage Computer forums at vintage-computer.com/VCForum. Also, new this year is our Facebook group. You can find us on facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast, where you can poke us and be friends with us and share photos and tag us. Yay! You can also send feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. A reminder that we are a member of the Throwback Network, found at throwbacknetwork.net, and they too have their own Facebook group, which we will link in the show notes. Whether or not you subscribe to us on iTunes, whatever your RSS or podcatcher of choice is, please do leave us a review on iTunes. That is not just for our own fragile egos. It actually does make our episode easier to find for other retro computing enthusiasts who are looking for a community to join. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time,
Retro Compute!